Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. I hope all our listeners had a nice holiday and managed to spend time with family and friends. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is hosted by the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. This radio show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, dial 347-994-1149. That is 347-994-1149. And press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today, I am going to urge you to call in to help save my voice. As you can tell, I'm a little bit under the weather. Joining us today are Eric Baltrinick and Patrick Canary from the Center for Innovative Practices within the Institute for the Study and Prevention of Violence at Kent State University. Patrick is the director of the Center for Innovative Practices. Prior to this position, he was an independent consultant specializing in community-based inter-system policy and program development with a particular focus on youth and family issues. Patrick previously served as chief of the Office on Children's Services, Ohio Department of Mental Health, and the associate director of a children's mental health center. He holds a bachelor's and master's degrees in special education and completed the Mental Health Executive Leadership Certificate Program at Case Western Reserve University. Eric is a project manager and consultant for the Center for Innovative Practices, where he provides instruction, consultation, and technical support at the local, state, and national levels on home-based treatment, co-occurring disorders, and multidimensional treatment foster care. He's one of the contributing developers of the Integrated Co-Occurring Treatment Model, a home-based service delivery model that utilizes an integrated approach to treating multiple system-involved youth. Eric has also served as an adjunct professor at the University of Akron Center for Family Studies. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the show is very timely, with changes soon to occur in many state administrations like Ohio, and every state worrying about their budgets. Often services for youth are one of the first line items to be examined for possible reduction. So let's jump in, and maybe you can tell our listeners, what have researchers learned over the years about the needs and issues of youth who enter the juvenile justice system?
Okay, this is Patrick speaking. And you're right, Lauren, it is going to be an interesting time for states, very challenging for all of the kids' systems. And I think what we're learning and have learned and continuing to learn about is just how multiple the issues and challenges are that our kids and families are facing. So, you know, just as our systems tend to be siloed by mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, delinquency intervention, educational intervention, you know, kids and families don't kind of divide themselves up that way. So I think what we're learning is that if we're not addressing kids and families in the context of all of those challenges, then we're not going to be doing the most effective job. So I think the research is telling us that, yes, while you need to pay attention to individual conditions or disorders, those need to be seen in a much more holistic way than I think traditionally, you know, we've been doing. And I think that we're beginning to see projects and interventions emerging that begin to break kind of the silos out and begin to look, you know, at a more ecological approach.
Great. The terminology evidence-based or evidence-informed has been used increasingly during the past few years, and it comes up again when people are looking at budgets. What does it mean as it pertains to practices, treatments, and interventions for youth. I know when I speak to, like, judges and lawyers, they think about evidence coming in before the court, but that's not what that is at all.
Well, actually, you know, actually, to some degree, that's actually a pretty good analogy, because to some degree, I mean, cases are won and lost, I suppose, on the strength of the evidence. And I think what we're finding in the human services, social services, behavioral health services arena is that there are indeed approaches and interventions that have more or less evidence behind them in terms of their ultimate effectiveness. And I think what you're seeing across the country is an increasing expectation by policymakers and funders, particularly, to deliver, quote, evidence-based practices or EBPs. I think people vary in terms of the preciseness of that definition, but generally it means that there is some decent level of science behind a particular intervention. So I think that's what we're finding now is one of the challenges in the provider field and in the treatment field, is really locking in on those practices that are effective and replicating those and making them available to the kids and families for which they are intended. And, you know, Eric has a lot of experience with implementation of such practices.
Yeah,
so maybe, Eric, you can respond to, when we're looking at replication, what are some of these common features of the evidence-based practices, if there are any?
I think some of the common features that are out there is that there's some sort of systematic approach that practice is taking, and that it's targeting a certain population with specific issues, maybe even disorders. I think there are some features the term is often used in the field, fidelity. So specific aspects of the program are conducted systematically and in accordance to what the standards of the program are, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Each of the programs has some sort of training and consultation component. So developers of a program will come in and teach the clinicians and supervisors and some administrators how the program works, what it looks like, what the actual interventions will entail, how to conduct those, and then we'll not just train and leave, but they'll stick around, and usually we'll meet with the clinical teams every week after they've been trained to kind of check in to see how things are going. That's important because, as Patrick mentioned, you know, there's evidence to support certain approaches. Part of the challenge, even though there is evidence, is putting them on the ground in agencies. So the consultation piece really helps with implementation of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some other features, some of the programs have manuals, which are guides for the clinicians and supervisors. They're not really intended to, you know, create clinical robots, but really to give people guides so that they can fall back on. People get busy, the work is very challenging, and it's nice to have reference. It's nice to have a common ground to talk with your supervisor about aspects of the intervention and also talk with the consultants about it. And then I would say, you know, of great importance is that there's a strength-based approach. There's often involvement and focus on the family, and we want to take into account any kind of cultural issues that might be relevant to the particular family and youth in question. Those are some things I can think of.
Yeah, and that's a great, I think that's a great laundry list, if you will, of kind of the characteristics, because we get asked that a lot. You know, part of the work of our center is to assist communities, courts, providers, policymakers, legislators, with feedback and information on, so what do I look for? I mean, that's an important question. And, you know, I think what we've learned over time is that, you know, I love this term that I heard from a colleague. You know, we've moved from the spray and pray concept, meaning we kind of spray the countryside with something and then we pray that somewhere it takes, that somewhere something will grow in its place. And I think what we're learning is that is not how good programs are replicated. Good programs require an enormous amount of preparation work, starting with selection and talking about what population are you trying to serve, what problem are you trying to address. And so, you know, there's more of a precision to it than I think we've been used to in the past in terms of matching specific programs to specific need. I mean, we often talk about the right program for the right youth in the right amount. That's kind of the equation that we're going for. We're trying to move away from the notion that is more service always better? Maybe we ought to be looking more at the right service at the right time. I mean, some research is beginning to tell us that if we miss certain windows of opportunity by applying the, quote, wrong intervention, and by that I simply mean one that isn't perhaps closely aligned with what we're trying to change, that the next time a youth becomes involved in treatment, their chances have kind of decreased. So it kind of is beginning to put pressure on us as providers to kind of get it right as soon as we can get it right. Now, that's obviously a lot easier, you know, said than done. I think the other challenge that we face with moving towards this evidence-based world, or evidence-informed, as some people call it, is this notion of, as Eric said, fidelity, meaning there is a way that this was intended to be done. And again, not robotically, and even in the highest manualized programs still have a great deal of flexibility. Relationships are still key to every intervention that that we use. The engagement with families, the engagement with youth, the buy-in, the trust, the hopefulness, all of that is still a key ingredient, whether you have a manual or not. But that fidelity piece is so important because as practitioners, we tend to drift to what may be more familiar to us. And so without...
And comfortable,
right.
Yeah.
And so without that fidelity check, without that kind of coaching aspect, we can begin to drift, and therefore the model that we're implementing doesn't quite get the effects that we're looking for. And then we have to go backwards and unpack, why aren't we getting the outcomes that we expect from this program? You know, how much of it is this and how much of it is that? And the other thing that we have to be careful of is the whole notion of adaptation. Many, many good programs have been sunk by being adapted, and yet the same expectation is being held. So we start with a program that says, gosh, your caseload should be 6. So we start with 6, and before you know it, it's 8, and, well, could you really take this family, and now it's 10. And before you know it, all of the things that the program was built on are beginning to be shaken. And what happens is the outcomes drop. And those are hard, you know, lines to toe for all of us because we, you know, we've all been trained certain ways, and hopefully we bring that training to the, you know, to the particular intervention. But it's also about learning new and different techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So Eric,
Patrick.
I was, is it okay to insert something here, Lauren?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
I wanted to circle back to the first question and tie the two together possibly, the whole idea of what are some of the issues of youth who enter the juvenile justice system. I think mm-hmm. it's important to remember that evidence-based practices or practices in general are developed to respond to needs, and I think that the juvenile justice system has some unique needs that really calls for the kind of I think the kind of things that appear in evidence-based practice that we've been talking about, some of the features. And some of the things that we see with the youth in the juvenile justice system, because the juvenile justice system really is the place that catches all of that,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you see a lot of complex clinical issues, co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders, problems at home, problems with school, histories of legal involvement that sort of progress over time, a history of youth being involved in what I would call single-episode treatments. So they may have been treated for a substance use problem and had mental health issues that predated that, like as early as grade school, or the other way around. And so you see a population in the juvenile justice system that's very, very complex, oftentimes clinically severe, multiple system involvement. And I think the more intense, as you move up in the juvenile justice system, the more severe or intense the supervision, from maybe traditional probation to intensive or even a specialized docket, you'll see their clinical needs increase in sort of a commensurate way. So I think the EBP development has been in response to, you know, these trends in this particular system. And you'll see that there have been specific ones that have been developed to respond to that. So I just wanted to kind of build a bridge between the questions, because I think they're interconnected.
Thank you. I think that's a really good segue into talking about some of the specific, because I think you both have outlined the challenges and some of the lessons learned from implementing them. But if we could kind of turn to what are some of these specific practices, and even though we do have people from around the country listening in, our primary audience is from Ohio, so if you could talk about what's going on in Ohio. But I think, Patrick, you also said we've learned about what practices may best treat what issues when we're talking about both engagement of the family and youth. So if you can both address that question.
Sure. And again, I can tie this to your earlier question as well about the research. And I think the good news is, in our state, is that people who have been in the position to make some choices and to make some decisions about what our public resources are going to support have obviously paid attention to the research and the literature, particularly in the juvenile justice field. You know, and by that I mean this is a population that I think has grown, the treatment pieces have grown by leaps and bounds over the last 10, 15 years, because I think for so long kids in the justice system were seen as almost an intractable population. You know, they wouldn't be here if we could have, you know, done something else. We wouldn't have incarcerated them if we could have, you know, done X, Y, or Z. And I think there was a long period of time at which we didn't feel confident that we had tools, particularly tools at the community level, that could effectively respond to the types of behaviors that we were seeing in a juvenile justice population, which are characteristics often shared by children that are also involved in the behavioral health system as well as child welfare. So when we look at the menu in Ohio, and, you know, keep in mind, we're a big state. I mean, we still have, you know, 8, 9, 10 million citizens in the state, meaning we probably have around 3 million kids. So when we talk about having a pretty rich menu, by that I mean we have a pretty good array of the kinds of services that you would want to see. I'm not so convinced that we have the depth that we need in order to address the need. But some of the programs that have really kind of, I don't want to say caught on, because I think that implies that it's relatively easy. But I think some of the programs that have taken hold in Ohio that are getting some terrific results are multisystemic therapy, MST. You know, that's kind of the code word for that particular service. Lots and lots and lots of research on this particular model that was specifically developed for a juvenile justice population, meaning kids with severe antisocial conduct disorder, disruptive behavior disorders, the kinds of things that clearly lead to kids being involved in the system and ultimately being incarcerated. MST is a community-based model. It is done in the community. It's done in the home. It's done intensively. It can be up to every single day of the week, multiple hours, and that includes weekends. It's a 24/7 program. So the results we're seeing in Ohio across our, I believe we have 15 teams now across the state, you know, the outcomes that we're seeing for MST are as good or better than the national averages for MST. A couple areas we still need to do a little better in, but I would put our data out there against any other state and certainly across the country. And the outcomes that we are concerned about and that we particularly measure are kids still at home? So these are kids that are on the verge of being placed one way or another. So we measure at the end of treatment, are kids still at home? Are they attending school or working and succeeding? Has there been a reduction in their involvement in the juvenile justice system? Have we engaged with the family? Is the family reporting improvements? So those are the real-world kind of functional outcomes that we measure in MST. A very similar approach in terms of looking at those same outcomes is functional family therapy. Ohio has a number of those programs, I think particularly clustered in the Cincinnati and I think Dayton area. FFT, again the shorthand, very effective program, again, for kids with serious behavior disorders. Again, a family approach. We're kind of echoing some of those characteristics you asked about, Lauren, in terms of what are some of the what are some of the aspects that models share. MTFC, and I'll let Eric talk about that. But again, there's a whole multidimensional family therapy. Again, a very effective program that, again, engages the whole family in treatment and uses the ecology, high-fidelity wraparound, strengthening families, incredible years. Now, the incredible years is targeted to a younger population. But, again, Ohio, and there's many I'm not mentioning, so I'm hoping any of our Ohio friends who are listening, if I've left you out, I'm sorry. Many, many programs that are being implemented. And I think Eric can give us more information on MTFC as well.
Sure.
As a program we've developed here for kids with co-occurring disorders of serious mental health issues as well as substance abuse.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. MTFC stands for Multidimensional Treatment Foster Care. And like MST or multisystemic therapy, it seeks to target youth antisocial behaviors. And so it's going to do things with parents, like try to improve their discipline practices, improve their relations, their consistency in parenting, supervising the youth's involvement in pro-social activities, things like that. Multidimensional treatment foster care takes a slightly different approach in that it seeks to teach the youth skills in the context of a therapeutic foster care environment. So the youth will come from, for example, an institution or juvenile justice setting into a foster care environment that it usually contains two foster parents trained in a special behavior approach. And they will work with that youth for 6 to 9 months as part of reunifying the youth back with their caregiver, with their primary caregiver. So they seek to skill train the youth pretty directly and also do some concurrent family therapy with the reunifying caregiver. So we have, I think, 8 programs in Ohio that are being implemented as part of a randomized clinical trial, and I supervise 4 of the teams. So got good outcomes. I would probably recommend for more information that you check out the website www.mtfc.com. It has everything that you would need and more to get more details on that.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds like there might be some lessons learned potentially for the juvenile justice side as well as youth are coming to reenter and reunify.
Yes.
With their families.
Yeah. Well, one thing I can tell you right off the top of the head, and this applies to our integrated co-occurring treatment program because we're rolling one out right now for reentry youth, is that programming for youth, you know, when I think of youth, I think of adolescents, you know, 12 to 18. And many of the youth that are reentering communities, especially if they've been in a DYS facility, are 18 to 22. So you're really talking about some transition age youth, you know, as opposed to, you know, kids along the adolescent spectrum. So that's something we can... that we're learning for sure. And some of the things right off the top of your head that you would want to take a look at when you're trying to implement an EBP is how involved is the family, you know, because many of the components of these models involve family work. And to what degree does the model have leeway for supported employment and things like that if we're talking about an emancipated
mm-hmm.
youth.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of things. And I think those are going to continue to be lessons learned over time for a lot of programs. Yeah.
So could you talk a little? I'm sorry.
Should I talk a little bit about ICT?
Yeah, I think so. I think it
okay.
Because it's pretty unique.
Okay. So one thing before to segue into talk about ICT is that in Ohio, and I'm sure in other states too, evidence-based practices can sort of be seen on a continuum. And one end, I would say, you know, treatment as usual. You go to work every day, you do counseling, you're informed, you're educated, you're supervised. And I know many wonderful practitioners that don't necessarily work as part of an evidence-based program. All the way to a promising practice, which is like ICT, which I'll describe in a minute, all the way up to an evidence-based practice with a lot of research and randomized clinical trials that show outcomes when you compare it to other treatments, like multisystemic therapy. So I think that that definitely, that continuum exists in Ohio and many other places.
Mm-hmm.
ICT, the Integrated Co-Occurring Treatment Program, fits in the promising practice part of the continuum there. And really what ICT is a home-based program that's designed to work with youth ages 12 to 18 who have co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders. And obviously they have some of the other characteristics that we see in the juvenile justice population. Multiple system involvements, including special education or alternative school placements, juvenile justice involvement, sometimes child welfare involvement, and those kinds of things. They have a long history of treatment episodes, and for our co-occurring youth, often they've been treated for one disorder or the other. So it's not as effective if you were to address both. So we design this model to be integrated in the sense that when we work with the youth, we're addressing both mental health and substance use disorders, and obviously working in the context of the home. We want to make sure that the youth can function well in their home and maintain their placement in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So we have several sites in Ohio. We have one in Summit County. We have one that we're just starting up for reentry youth in Franklin. We have one in Cuyahoga, McHenry County, Illinois, and Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Great.
Yeah.
Are there other promising practices around the country that you would like to see being brought to Ohio? And before you respond to that, I just want to remind our listeners that they can also ask questions by calling 347-994-1149 or entering their question into the chat room. Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
You know, that's a really good question, Lauren. I think, you know, not to sound like Ohio knows it all, because we don't, but we know a lot. Yes, I am sure there are programs that we ought to be spending more time looking at. But more than that, you know, Eric kind of touched on this, and I think it's an important point. Not every evidence-based practice is part of a complex model. And most of the ones we've talked about, MST, functional family therapy, multidimensional treatment, foster care, they are indeed complex in terms of their implementation and their sustainability. And I think anybody listening, whether in Ohio or across the country, that is implementing any one of these programs will certainly attest to that. They're not the easiest things to get on the ground, and they're not always the easiest things to sustain over time. There's lots of challenges. However, individual practitioners, whether they're in a private practice or whether in one of our many community mental health centers or kids agencies, there are many practices that at the individual practitioner level are certainly considered evidence-based practices, like trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And approaches like that, motivational interview, enhanced interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of skills and treatment options that folks can be trained in and coached in that really can become, you know, part of your, as an individual practitioner, part of your toolkit, so that when you are seeing youth in families who may have, you know, a particular condition that one of these treatments would, you know, be effective for, that you can indeed be using, you know, an evidence-based practice. So sometimes we think about them as being kind of always, you know, this kind of short list of the FFTs, MFTs, MDFTs. So I think part of our challenge is, do we have a workforce that feels that it has the tools that it needs in his or her toolkit to address some of the issues they're seeing in the kids and families? And if not, what are the ones that we want to reinforce for people or train people up to and help coach them with those? And I think that's a huge kind of workforce development issue that Ohio and certainly many other states are facing.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that point, I know people always say, well, you know, I'm from a rural area or I'm from an urban, or that wouldn't work here. Are there differences depending whether a community is rural, urban, or the ethnicity or socioeconomic background of the family or youth when it comes to the effectiveness of any of these practices?
My, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, but so I, my comments are from, you know, kind of osmosis and observation and talking to, you know, my colleagues who are clinicians and practitioners. I think what the difference often is not so much the particular intervention technique as to whether it is effective or not. I think it often has to do with the environment and the setting in which you're trying to implement a particular service. So, for example, MST requires that you have a certain number of referrals in order to make the program viable, both clinically and, quite honestly, financially. So the challenge of implementing a program that has a low caseload requirement of only 4 to 6 families at any given time per therapist can be very difficult to implement in a community where the population base would not support that type of program, as opposed to a Cleveland or Columbus, where the numbers are surely there to support that type of intervention. So that's part of that selection process, is what will fit in my community. So if I'm coming at it from, you know, that perspective, and I look at, you know, what will meet the needs of the citizens and kids living in my community, I may not pick some of the things that, from an effectiveness point of view, we know, quote, work, because it isn't going to fit or it isn't going to fly for other reasons. And those are totally legitimate in terms of planning and implementation. So all of those factors that you mentioned, you know, have to be characterized. Now, I can tell you that, and again, not a researcher, but certainly, you know, becoming familiar with, you know, the research, I can tell you particularly in MST, in the studies that have been done, when the factors of race, ethnicity, gender, and socioeconomic status are removed as indicators in the database, it does not significantly change the outcomes. So one can, I guess, surmise that the effectiveness of the treatment is pretty universal if it's applied according to the model. So that would be one example that I could give.
Great.
I could add some to that question too. I think
definitely.
Give us a couple examples. if you go to a site like NREP, the National Registry of Evidence, what is the acronym, Patrick? National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs
and Practices.
Mm-hmm. And practices.
Yep.
If you go to that website, NREP, and type in a practice, you'll find, as part of their research, they'll show studies that are outcome studies. So there's a particular effect for a certain population. So you can, when you're looking at differences for these factors, you can look at outcomes or effectiveness for the actual treatment. But then I think Patrick also illustrated that when you're implementing a program, sometimes you have to take that into consideration when being a consumer and looking at different EVPs and that kind of thing. So you have to kind of look at it ahead of time. So when you're consuming information about outcomes or effectiveness of programs, you might want to be also thinking about what would this be like to roll it out in our neighborhood, basically. And
right.
And I can give you a clinical example of that. For example, we had an integrated co-occurring treatment program that we implemented in the Salinas Valley in California. And one of the things that, you know, we had some preliminary data from other sites, you know, and that shows, you know, it does a pretty good job. But obviously our population there was predominantly Spanish-speaking, and we had to make some adjustments in the implementation approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you know, rolling it out, I think, is important when you consider your community as, you know, outcomes, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then you may want to look in a different area for that. Another thought that I learned, one of the lessons I learned as a consultant from the developers of MTFC is that, you know, when they try a program that's already got good outcomes and they expand it to say maybe you work with girls instead of boys, they might not get the same outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that information to learn from that to say, what do we need to change about this program so it can be more effective? So I like to see if developers have learned those lessons or what they have to say about that, because then, you know, that can kind of inform, is there room to grow if we invest
mm-hmm.
in this,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, all of this sounds wonderful, and you've really been talking about community and home-based interventions and treatments.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some common misconceptions about these?
Oh, yeah. and I think that's part of our job. I mean, part of our job is to help, whether it's a community or a provider or a planning authority or a legislator. You know, part of our job is to help, you know, figure out what the expectation is. And there's one thing that I almost always caution people about is, be very careful of the overpromise of the intervention. And I'm not saying that that's done in any deliberate way, because I don't believe that it is. But I think that what can happen is when you match high need, meaning a community that might be really feeling quite desperate about needing to do something, you know, there's an urgency to implementing something, you know, fill in the blank, whatever that might be, that there can be kind of a moment of maybe I'm not scrutinizing this as carefully as I need to, and I'm maybe more quick to jump to something that sounds like this could be the answer. And, of course, I think, as we all know, there is no the answer. There are multiple answers. It's complicated. But I do caution people about the overpromise of the intervention, because if you lift the data or the outcomes out of the context, you know, it can appear one way. And so I think part of our job is to make sure that it's in context. I think the other challenge in this area is we don't have treatment interventions for every type of condition or disorder that our kids and families are facing. I mean, we, you know, our toolkit is growing continually. But I think what we don't know is still, you know, a big factor. And so sometimes we look to these programs maybe with the expectation of fulfilling a need that perhaps they were never intended to fulfill. So we have to be very cautious about, again, that expectation. The other thing that I caution people about is what we talked a little bit about earlier, and that is if you're going to, you know, so one of the things we often hear, using MST as an example, is MST is designed and researched for kids between the ages of 12 and 17. I mean, that is the ideal age range. So we'll often get questions from people about, well, what about kids that are 10 and 11, you know, who may be showing signs of antisocial behavior or have serious signs of conduct or disruptive disorders? Why can't we refer those kids to MST if indeed those kids look the same as older kids? And our answer is because that's not the population for whom this treatment program was researched. Now, it begs the question of adaptation. It begs the question of should we look at doing some more research and bringing that very legitimate questions. But to do that kind of independent of the model, I think kind of invites probably not the not the path we want to go down. So I think overpromise, maybe higher expectations. So as excited as we can get about talking about some of the things that we think are good things, I think we have to temper that with also the reality of that we don't know everything about what's needed.
I think that's well said, Patrick. I just want to add that, I would say, and you kind of hinted at this, utilization of the program.
Mm-hmm.
We're all faced with real problems, youth and families with real needs. And so your providers are often put in a situation where they need something for the kids. Many things haven't worked. The continuum of services is still growing, and so there's the idea of I need to put this kid somewhere, and so I think utilization of the actual program that's in a community often leads to maybe diluting it because mm-hmm. they want to make a referral because they have good intentions and want service for the kid, but it's maybe not necessarily the best fit. It's much mm-hmm. more complicated to work with providers to design individual treatment, versus saying here's a program that's all kind of all together and ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't necessarily fix everything. They help outcomes and improve the treatment process for youth and families. But I think a lot of what I see on the ground clinically is that good people who work in different, systems want something for their kids because a lot of things haven't worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes it's an issue of, everybody wanting something good and trying to figure out what that is, if that makes
right.
any sense.
Right. Well, and I think those of us in this field, have a strong feeling about we need to do something. And that's a good feeling and a good intention, but always has to be tempered with let's make sure the something actually
right.
meets the need that we're saying we need to do something about.
That's right.
It goes back to what I was saying earlier about, is more of something always better, or is it about, kind of the right thing? And I know that, I know as I'm sitting here that judges and prosecutors and defense lawyers and advocates are, all challenged by, but we don't have enough of the some things. And I get that. And I totally get that.
Well, that kind of brings up a question we had sent in by Jeff, along with something else I really wanted to ask you. Maybe you can address both of them at the same
sure.
time. So why should communities be thinking about these practices that you've discussed versus institutionalizing kids? And if I want, short of bringing both of you to my community, to get them excited about this, which you do a great job at, What do I need to do to educate my partners and my stakeholders, the courts, the prosecutors, behavioral health, to better understand how to get appropriate services to the youth?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me the first part of the question again, Lauren. I got the education piece, and I wrote that down. But what was the top part of the question again?
Why should communities think about these treatment
yeah.
versus institutionalization.
Yeah, and I think the way we think about it is an array of services.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly are not in any way anti-strategic use of placement when that's necessary, and that can be necessary due to safety reasons. It can be necessary due to stabilization purposes. But I think if we look at the arc over the last 20 years of how we thought about placement as a treatment option versus community-based, I think we're beginning to see the dial kind of move a bit. I think there always will be a place in our continuum for the strategic use of placement, but I think increasingly we're finding that many of the tools we're developing using home and in-home and community-based services can be effective and can be done with a level of safety that is acceptable and appropriate. to all of the parties. So I don't think it's an either or. I think it's what's available in your mix. And again, what's the best option for what is, you know, kind of happening at that moment? What's the best treatment option? So, for example, the work that Eric is doing with multidimensional treatment foster care, that is definitely an out-of-home placement. This is a decision that's been made at the court level that mm-hmm. this youth is not returning home yet. And so what do we need to do to maximize the success when that youth does go home and when that family does reunify? So, you know, for me, again, it's this notion of if I'm a community leader of any kind and I step back and look at my resource pool, do I believe that I have the level and array of choices needed in my community to respond to the challenges of, you know, that we're seeing? And residential may be a part of that. But it also may be we don't have anything here that responds to families in their own home or in the school or in a community context. Maybe that's where we ought to start building, you know, some of our capacity.
I also think that, you know, considering these options versus institutionalization is just basically looking at the issues related to delinquent behavior itself.
Right.
You know, if you look at research that leads to the development of evidence-based practices, there's a lot of factors that contribute to the behaviors that lead to, you know, charges. And a lot of them have to do with risk factors in the home and that kind of thing. Things that are, in many ways, treatment related issues. And so while not making excuses for, you know, violating rights of others and breaking the law, we do know that many of the issues are related to other things, and those fall sort of in the territory of providing treatment.
Yeah, and I think the real challenge is how do we unpack all of that in a very deliberate way and attend to those things that are treatment oriented and that we can, you know, again, bring our tools to. How to address the criminogenic aspects of what's going on, and again, kind of trying to approach that from a holistic point of view. And I think, you know, I think testament to that is, you know, our own, you know, state system, our own ODYS, you know, made the commitment to reduce the numbers of kids in incarcerated. And the way they chose to do that was to leverage resources at the local level for people in communities to develop alternatives to incarceration, and through the Behavioral Health Juvenile Justice Initiative, which, by the way, the report for that is on the ODMH website, if people are interested. And I think it's under Behavioral Health Juvenile Justice. If you Google that at ODMH, you should go to the report. The outcomes have been, you know, I think pretty phenomenal, as they have been with Targeted Reclaim, which has given additional resources to the six metro counties who obviously incarcerate, you know, the larger number of kids across our state, by leveraging dollars to develop intensive community programs, and some of them are residential-based, but many of them are community-based, are getting, you know, significant reductions in the numbers of kids that are coming to the state authority. That is only good news for now. For every kid, every time, every situation, absolutely not. But when you look at where we were even 2, 3, 4 years ago in terms of the numbers at the state to where we are now, clearly something is at work here. And part of that has been a refocus on what can be done at an intensive community level that can also support the issues of safety for everybody concerned.
I also think just at the ground level, you know, for example, if from a clinical perspective or an agency perspective, these things are rolled out with partners in the community, and that often
right.
involves probation, parole. We do this work together. Every site that we do consultation for, any program training we do, is always mindful of our community partners, and by that I
yep.
mean child welfare, probation, parole, schools. We work better together than apart. And we see that
That's
over
right.
and over again each time we roll out a new program.
Yeah.
So
you know, yeah, the notion of people going at this alone, the implementation of some of these practices, you know, that's usually the first question I ask when I get an inquiry about doing MST or doing another program is whether the call is from a provider or from the court is who are your other partners at both publicly and privately that want to support you in this, because it's going to take that to implement it successfully and to sustain it. So while it may be driven by a particular system, and maybe it's driven by the mental health system or driven by the juvenile justice system, the ultimate ownership for implementation and success really is got to, you know, be shared among at least the public partners in order. Mm-hmm. And certainly implementers are generally private in our state. So it is a public-private partnership that needs to happen.
Great. And we are running out of our time, and I think you might have noticed that in an effort to get through some of the information, you threw some acronyms out, and I just want to make sure that in case our listeners don't know, ODYS, Ohio Department of Youth Services, ODMH, Ohio Department of Mental Health. We all speak in acronyms, and we don't realize that sometimes people don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah,
so,
and you warned us not to do that.
Well, it was an hour ago.
Yeah, I know.
Short-term memory is the first thing to go.
That's right. Just in these last few minutes, is there anything you want to share with our listeners about the Center for Innovative Practices?
Well, you had asked the question about, how do people kind of get knowledge about this or get more information. And again, fortunately, we are in a state that I think has some pretty terrific resources. The Judicial College attached to the Supreme Court has done a wonderful job working with courts around evidence-based programs and how to think about implementation, as well as the Judges Association does a marvelous job of educating and bringing awareness to its membership. And we as an organization here at Kent State certainly are available to do consultation, to, you know, give you our opinion if you want, to hunker down with you if you want, you know, depending on what your needs are. And you're welcome to contact me as the director of the center at any point. And if it's only just sending you stuff, we're happy to do that. We have a pretty good laundry list of resources that we send out to people in terms of these are the things that we generally feel reliable. If you check here, here's what our portfolio looks like if it's something more specific to what we do. I wish I could say we do all of these programs. We don't. We only are involved in a handful as well. But our job is to get information about all of these services out to folks and help people make the best decisions. It's not just about what we have in our portfolio.
We have a website, www.cipohio.org, and that has contact information on it as well, and brief descriptions of our program areas. But I think to reinforce what Patrick said, we also do individual consultations in the form of just, you know, talking a little bit, finding out what you need, and definitely if it's not something that we have in-depth knowledge about, we can get information to help individuals or groups of people make decisions about how to move forward.
Right.
So.
Well, I would like to thank both of you for taking the time to be here today. And thank the listeners for tuning in. The show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. Our next show will be this Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll have the founders of Strategies for Youth speaking about improving youth police interactions to reduce system involvement. That should be an interesting show. So to stay informed about that show and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit www.childrenslawky.org. Have a good day, and we'll see you next time here on Spotlight on Youth.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Lauren.